Welcome to Sense and Sustainability, your podcast channel for sustainable procurement. We hope you like what you hear. Please go to www.iso2400.org for more information, learning resources, tools, and much more.
Hello and welcome to this podcast. It's a recording of my interview with Speedy Services at their Speedy Expo at the end of 2022. We expanded into a number of subjects around sustainability, a little bit of my history in the Olympics, and things that have driven us towards a sustainable world today. Do have a listen. I think you'll enjoy it. Thank you.
And welcome back to Liverpool and the Speedy Expo 2022. Now, sustainability has very much been the theme of the day so far, and I'm delighted to say that I am joined by Sean McCarthy. You are now going to talk to me all about sustainability because I have been told you are the man.
Yeah, no pressure there.
No pressure there then. First of all, and I've been asking this question to some of the other people who have been talking to me about it today. But to me, sustainability feels very much like a new topic.
Mm-hmm.
How long do you think it has been in the consciousness, particularly within construction, which I would say is slightly incongruous to the phrase sustainability. The two don't sort of naturally match.
Well, I've been doing this one way or another for 20 years, so it's not that new. And I don't come from a sustainability background as a professional. I was a procurement guy that, you know, kind of gradually got the idea that we can use our leverage as procurers to do good things, you know, to reduce emissions, to increase social value, to improve employment, local conditions, and all those things. So it kind of came to me a long time ago. Within the industry and what we see out here today with all the lovely, you know, zero emissions, low carbon, battery, electric, hydrogen, wonderful stuff. In the last 2 years, I think it really has become a thing. And oddly enough, since the COVID crisis, it's become even more in the public consciousness. And that's interesting because when we had the 2008 global financial crisis, sustainability went away and everybody worried about the economy.
Yeah.
And I was thinking after COVID, well, you know, the economy is going to take a hit. Is sustainability going to go down the agenda? It hasn't. It really has. So for me, in the last couple of years, it's very much here to stay, and we've seen evidence of that all day today. Practically every stand here at the exhibition has got something low carbon, has got something innovative to show, and that's a fantastic step forward.
One of the big key takeouts I remember from the first big lockdown was because everybody was now sat at home looking at the sky, and of course we had the most tremendous weather. It was like everybody suddenly engaged again and suddenly remembered and suddenly felt much more connected to the environment. And so it doesn't actually surprise me that it did not slip down the agenda, even though there was a cost that, you know, we've got to think about the global economy at the same time. Your role now within sustainability is quite significant.
Yeah, I do several things. I run a small business, so it's, in that sense, it's not that significant. I started Action Sustainability in 2006 because I used to go to lots of government meetings about sustainable procurement, and quite frankly, there'd be a big room full of people who'd never bought anything or didn't really know what they were doing. And I looked around and thought, well, there's no help for anybody out there to procure more sustainably, so why don't I start a business to do that? I also took a role at the same time as chair of something called the Commission for Sustainable London 2012. And that was quite high profile. That was like a strategic assurance body overseeing the sustainability of the London Olympics. We won the bid in 2005, and that role went all the way through to 2013. It was supposed to be a three-day-a-week role. It was really two full-time jobs at the time. So I learned a lot from that experience and kind of fed that into what I do now. So in 2012, we started something called the Supply Chain Sustainability School. And the idea of that was to bring partners together, maybe companies that traditionally competed with each other in the construction sector, with a common objective to upskill their supply chains. So we started the school with seven partners, and now we've got something like 185 in a 10-year period. And that movement, I suppose, has become a major force for sustainability in the industry. So we not only run a virtual learning environment to upskill tens of thousands of people per annum, we also work collaboratively with the industry to set new standards and to innovate new things. So, for instance, we've done a lot of work in modern slavery. We've done a lot of work on looking at how we improve employment standards in the industry, a lot of work on carbon. We've got a very active climate action group that's rolling out a free carbon calculator, to work on circular economy and how we can create a nice little GIS map of waste transfer stations around the country. So you want to take your surplus material somewhere to get some money back from it. You might want to buy surplus material from another site rather than buying new material, but you don't know where to go because you've just rocked up on a new site somewhere in the country that you've never been before. You've got no local knowledge. So very simple. Go in the school, take a look at the map, find somewhere to go. So we've been rolling out solutions like that and also new standards. So the school has become very influential over the last 10 years.
But it sounds to me as well like awareness is probably one of the biggest challenges that you have, because when people talk about sustainability, you think about carbon, I mean, that's probably the first, and waste.
Yeah.
That's probably the two, but you know, you're referring to modern slavery as well. Yeah. So how much education in what sustainability actually means is required still?
Yeah, it is. I mean, we have 17 topics that cover the broad remit of sustainability within the school. Not all of those topics apply to everybody.
Mm.
So we have some software on the platform that enables you to go in and say what sort of business you are, you know, what category of supplier you're in. And then the system will choose the priorities for you. So if I look at an example, a cleaning contractor in facilities management, they probably don't need to be too worried about carbon emissions compared to some very carbon intensive products. I'm not saying don't worry about carbon emissions, but maybe worry a little less. But you might be much more concerned about labour standards, about modern slavery, maybe about environmental protection with chemicals, etc. So the system will feed you those topics. Otherwise, it becomes very overwhelming.
Mm.
So,
and it's very easy to disengage if you're...
Yeah, you look at it and go, God, I can't cope with all this. So the school actually gives you, these are the priority topics for you. And because we have 185 or thereabouts partners in the school now, which is from the very big clients like National Highways, like Network Rail, through the Tier 1 contractors, many suppliers and many smaller businesses, the message to the industry is, this is what your clients are asking you to learn. You've got 180-odd businesses that are saying, actually, if you're a cleaning contractor, I want you to understand about labour standards and modern slavery. If you're a concrete supplier, I want you to understand about embodied carbon. If you're a demolition contractor, I want you to understand about waste and recycling. So it's really about setting those priorities and helping people to understand where they put the most effort in delivering on the sustainability agenda. Otherwise, yeah, as you say, people would disengage, they'd get very scared, and they walk away from the whole thing.
Now, you mentioned London 2012.
Mm.
The remit for that was being carbon neutral. No, it wasn't.
The promise was to be the most sustainable game ever.
Most sustainable game.
And it was my job, basically, to say...
And how do you measure that? How do you target?
Yeah.
And I have to say, OBE, as a consequence,
yeah.
So... Congratulations to people
Thank you.
On that.
Yeah, that was a surprise, I must say.
So, to be the most sustainable games ever,
yeah.
How do you target?
Okay, what you need to remember that the promise to deliver the most sustainable games ever was made in 2005. And the facilities, the permanent facilities, were delivered in the period sort of 2007 to 2011. So it's quite a long time ago now.
Yeah.
It really is. What we looked at the time was a whole gamut of indicators. So, yes, there were the carbon emissions in construction, in the construction process, the carbon emissions in actually staging the games, and how efficient the venues were, and logistics and transport, and those sorts of things. London 2012 was the first zero waste to landfill games ever in the world, and that was achieved successfully. Albeit they burnt quite a lot of the waste, but, you know, we won't necessarily go there. It was zero to landfill. But also we looked at the impact, the reason that the Olympics went to East London was all about regeneration of that part of London. It was a very poor, very deprived in every measure of deprivation. And Mayor Ken Livingstone at the time, who was supporting the Games, described it as a once-in-200-year opportunity for regeneration interrupted by 6 weeks of sport.
Yeah.
Now, Ken was part of the Olympic board, and so was Lord Coe, Sebastian Coe. And for him, of course, it was all about the sport.
Yeah.
So, and they were at very different political ends of the spectrum as well. So what we did was we looked at things like, are you employing and upskilling people locally? The London Borough of Newham, a very deprived borough, something like at the time 60% of its population was aged under 16, 60% of the population didn't declare themselves as white British. There was a whole potential workforce there that you could tap into. What are you doing about that? Not only during the construction of the facilities and the staging of the Games, but also in the legacy. And one of the best examples for me was the media centre. 1 million square feet, building that looks like an aircraft hangar with loads of tech in it, and the world's media turn up to broadcast the Olympics for 6 weeks and then they go away again. What do you do with that building after you've used it? In Beijing, as far as I'm aware, it's still derelict. Athens, the same. London, okay, what will we do? Lots of different options were being looked at. It was going to be a distribution centre for Tesco at one point, which horrified me, because that's lots of low-paid jobs and not really what we want. Ultimately, what happened was BT Vision came in to use that building as their headquarters, because there was plenty of technology infrastructure there. Then Loughborough University came into the building, and they put their Centre for Artificial Intelligence, Research into Artificial Intelligence, into that building. And other high-tech organisations have since come. That opens up an enormous number of potential high-tech jobs for those young people in the industry that are leaving school and, you know, in an area where there's very little hope of gainful employment. So there were lots of different ways that we looked at sustainability. Ultimately, my final report as chair of the commission was something called Making a Difference. And what we looked at there was to say, well, we've done what we've done on the Olympics. You know, it was pretty good for the time. It was pretty good. But what difference has it made? Has it made a difference to the construction industry? Yes, it did. Because construction contractors were driven to actually deliver on their sustainability promises, not just write lots of flowery words in their tender and then carry on doing what they were doing before. Has it made a difference to the major events sector? Yes. Qatar World Cup claims to be carbon neutral. Not sure about that, but it claims to be. There were some amazing innovations at the Tokyo Olympics. You know, the Super Bowl is carbon neutral and zero waste. All of those things, all of that was driven by the example from London 2012, because I always said there's no such thing as a sustainable Olympic Games. How can you bring all these people from all over the world using all of those emissions and all of those logistics and use all of that stuff to watch a few people running around for 6 weeks and then they go away again? That's not sustainable. The only thing that is sustainable is the legacy that you leave behind.
Yeah. So, obviously, as you say, that was now some time ago.
Yeah.
Things have moved on at a pace. How has that experience helped the school and helped the panel? And how has it all developed from there?
Yeah, we pretty much started the school because of the Olympics.
Yeah.
Because I had the role that I had, demanding that the various different Olympic delivery bodies actually deliver on their sustainability objectives. That had quite a profound effect on the supply chain. We really had to do it rather than talking about it. And then Skanska came to my business as consultants to say, we want to be the most sustainable construction company in the world. And we've worked out that 80% of our revenue goes to our supply chain. And our supply chain is not competent to deliver on our sustainability objectives. Mr. Clever Consultant, what do you think we can do about that? And that's really where we invented the school. And we said to Skanska, look, you know, you've got thousands of small businesses in your supply chain, and your peers have thousands of small businesses. They're often the same businesses. So what we need to do is to get together to create a virtual learning environment for those small businesses. And we managed to find six other businesses at the time that believed in that vision. We went and got some money from CITV to start the school as seed funding. And we started the supply chain school with seven partners. So that was pretty much a direct result of the learning from the Olympics. The other thing that I learned many things, but the other thing that I learned that has an impact on what we do today was all about measurement and measurement of performance, because the Olympic Delivery Authority, the ODA, required reporting every month from every contractor. How much waste, how much carbon, how many apprentices, how many local employees, how much are you spending with local businesses, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that gave rise to a Tower of Babel of spreadsheets. Everybody had a different version of the same spreadsheet, and they're all computer. It was incredibly labor-intensive to try and collect that data. And I thought, well, there must be a piece of software somewhere in the world that enables people to do that. And we did lots of market research and found out there wasn't, so we developed our own. So we now have something called Sustainability Tool, which again came as a direct result of the Olympics to say there has to be a piece of software, and if there isn't, then we'll develop a piece of software. And many of our clients now buy into everything we do. So we help them as consultants with their strategies and their implementation plans. Then they work out that they need to upskill their supply chain, so they need the school. And then they work out that they need to measure their performance, so they need some software to do it. So all of that stuff, a very large percentage of the thinking came from my experience in the Olympics. Not all of it, but a very large percentage of it has given rise to that sort of strategic program of work that we have now, that we've engaged the construction industry in, and pretty much everybody here today is a partner in the school, and everybody's talking about it, and that's what we do.
And of course, you're also now working with Dan Evans, the new
CEO.
So how's that? Obviously, it fits very much into what they're trying to achieve as a business as well.
Yes, Speedy joined the school a few years ago. You know, when we started the school, it was mostly the Tier 1 contractors, and then gradually various others have joined. And the school fits very well with what Speedy are trying to do. And the way that the school actually helps them to engage with their client base is fantastic. Dan then applied to join the governance board of the supply chain school, and he's been with us on the board for a couple of years now. He brings a fantastic perspective because if it's all heads of procurement from Tier 1 contractors, you're in danger of groupthink.
Yes.
Dan comes at it from a very different angle, much more thinking about the customer, much more thinking about the value chain and products and services that can kind of feed into the sector. So it's really good to get that diversity of thought on the board.
And in terms of moving forward, how does one move forward, and how does one sort of expedite the changes that are necessary?
Well, I guess if we look at the school, we have a massive ambition to be engaging 100,000 people in the learning each year within the next few years. At the moment, it stands at about 17,000, so it's quite a challenge. So we need to think through how we do that. We need to think through how we engage with those smaller businesses down the value chain. We've got much smarter at marketing, at sort of automated marketing. So things like you go on Amazon.com and you buy a dog lead, and it said, oh, you might be interested in this, this can of beans or whatever it might be. So we've instigated that type of approach that says, well, you've been looking at the carbon pages. Well, you might be interested in this video. You might want to take this self-assessment. You might want to join this group. So we've looked at being much more sophisticated around marketing. We've got 20-odd different groups now within the school that engage around different things. So if I look at carbon as an example, we've got a climate action group. That climate action group has four work streams that they're working on, looking at embodied carbon, looking at rolling out a free, very simple carbon calculator so small businesses can start to collect information about their carbon emissions and manage them free of charge. Bigger businesses then can start to gather data about their supply chains. So, Speedy Hire, you've got this many suppliers in your business, they're all using this carbon calculator. You can start to get some information about the operational carbon footprint of your supply chain. So it's looking where we can provide tools and solutions to take things forward. I was speaking on the panel earlier today about, you know, the rush for electric technology, tools and plants and all of those things. National Highways came to one of our meetings to say, this is great, you know, we really want all this stuff. Our issue is about grid connections.
Yeah.
You know, we build all around the country. These construction sites are temporary sites. They're sometimes, you know, in the middle of nowhere. We would love to have electric diggers, but we've nowhere to plug them in.
No.
And we can't get the infrastructure suppliers to get the infrastructure to our sites quickly enough before we've gone away. Now, National Grid are partners in the school. You know, Northern Electric Networks are partners in the school. Most electricity infrastructure companies in the UK and in Ireland, as it happens, are in the school. So, okay, let's get them together then.
Well, I was about to say, having that sort of wealth of experience in mind.
Yeah.
Can help iron out some of those issues.
So we have that platform.
Interesting. All of what you're saying, this is coming from sort of the industry out as opposed to policy in.
Mm.
Is that a pattern, a trend that you...
Yes and no. I always say that the success of the supply chain school is down to no involvement whatsoever from government. It's an industry initiative. We did have some industry funding from CITB, but then the contractors put the money into CITB in the first place, so we didn't engage with government because I think it would have slowed us down.
Yeah.
So I think because it's an initiative for the industry, by the industry, that gives us an amazing amount of power. But what is happening now is a lot of the procurement rules in the public sector are changing. So PPN 0620, Procurement Policy Notice, 06-2020 has made a huge difference
yeah.
to the construction industry. Because what that said, quite simply, if you're a public purchaser, you must allow 10% of your tender evaluation on social value. So suddenly, that makes a difference between winning a job and losing a job. If you're a contractor, you know, let's face it, the price of a job is pretty close. So actually, that element of social value and how well you can present yourself to deliver social value can make a big difference. But that's procurement leverage writ large. So government procurement does make a difference. And the way that the public sector behaves, if you look at some of the plant that Speedy provide with electric, solar, battery and all of those things, HS2 and National Highways basically insist on that. You know, fossil fuel plant, unless you've got a very good reason, you know, not to use more modern technology, then you're using the modern technology and those are the rules and that's it. So I think those public procurers being driven by policy are making a difference. And there's quite a stark difference between that and, say, some commercial building developments where, you know, the developers or the funding bodies from wherever they are in the world are not placing as stringent a standard as that, or they're doing the very minimum they have to do to get their Section 106 planning agreement, that drives different behaviour. So we might see the same contractor, an Alphabetia or Morgan Sindler or Skanska or whatever, behaving very differently if they're working for HS2 or National Highways compared to if they're working for a development company in the City of London yeah. or wherever. So it does make the industry a bit schizophrenic, shall we say, in terms of the way that it operates, driven by the client. So, yeah, not so much government policy, but policy plays a role, but it's more than those, you know, the public sector is the biggest procurer in the country. And if they're starting to use their procurement power to drive change, then it does make a difference.
Well, Sean, I reckon we could just talk about this for the rest of the afternoon, but I'm probably conscious I probably ought to let you go.
Okay.
But it's been absolutely fascinating to talk to
you. Yes, I enjoyed it. Thanks very much. Thank you.
So I hope you enjoyed that recording. Thanks again to Speedy for hosting the event and for conducting such an inspiring interview. And we do look forward to future episodes on Sense and Sustainability. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to our podcast on Sense and Sustainability. Please listen out for more episodes. For more information, learning resources, tools, and much more content on sustainable procurement, go to www.iso2400.org.